was a great rendering of that great, great story. Let me also say good morning and welcome to any of you who are visiting here. We're delighted you've joined us. Our family moved about a year ago, and as a result of having moved, we were privileged to be part of a summer supper club this year. And it's been a great experience, a connection of people, a leisurely meal, usually a potluck, no hurry to be done. It's sort of the opposite of fast food and grab a bite kind of mentality. And I even got a chance to learn a new lawn game this summer. Never heard of Coob before, but it's like wooden soldiers, Viking soldiers you set out and try and knock down, and they got soldiers and you got soldiers, and kind of a cross between chess and bowling, it seems like. So the supper club was great, and it is a reminder that in every time and place, table fellowship has significance. Those who share a meal together connect in ways that you don't under any other circumstance, I'm going to find the high point of the tale of the prodigal son, the parable of the prodigal son, is a feast. It is table fellowship that is the center point of this story, a great celebratory party. And in the times Jesus inhabited, much more than ours even, who you ate with, under what circumstances you ate with them, conferred not just a pleasant gathering, but questions of significance and honor and dishonor and your place in society and standing, and all of those were always at stake when a meal was shared. The Lord tells a great many stories in which a banquet features prominently. Who gets invited to the banquet? Who's ready is prepared when the banquet occurs? Where do you sit at the banquet? And is your seat going to be changed in some significant way? And a number of his instructions, a number of his teachings revolve around table fellowship, and so it is with this one as well. I want to begin by reading the opening of Luke 15. We've been studying the Gospel of Luke this summer and are kind of nearing the end. Summer is, of course, nearing the end. We're nearing the end of these studies, and we're taking up now the best-loved, most famous of Jesus' parables. Luke 15 begins this way. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to him, and the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." The problem is not that Jesus talked at sinners or glanced at sinners or had an opinion about sinners, but that he ate with them. That he had familiar, close-knit, open conversation with sinners. That he paid them the respect of having table fellowship with them. And this is, of course, outrageous to the Pharisees. And so he responds by telling a series of parables, all of which have about them the quality of something lost being found, and where he's trending toward is telling the story of sons who are lost that are found. It's the longest and greatest of these parables. And there are two sons, both of whom are welcome at the feast. The story ends open-endedly. We don't know exactly what will happen. There is no complete resolution. There's invitation without resolution. And I hope we'll find ourselves this morning somewhere in the story, somewhere connecting to some part of it, and realize that we today, this morning before we're done, have a meal to share together. Table fellowship with Jesus extended to us in the meal he gave us to remember his death. And that perhaps as a result of what we see, we'll find ourselves grateful and appreciative and worshipful as we partake of this meal together. So we've already heard the story, It would have been probably somewhat familiar even if we hadn't. What's going on? There are three scenes that unfold. It's a fairly longish text, and the first scene is the story of a descent into ruin, if you will. And we'll talk some about how that proceeds, how the younger son, in a series of choices, takes himself to the lowest possible place. It is the anti-banquet scene, if you will, where he's left in a place where there is nothing to eat, no companions, no celebration, there's nothing but pigs, and there's no food at all for him. He couldn't descend to a lower place. Pigs are the kind of the worst possible animal to be associated with, and there he is, longing to have the life of a pig. The second scene is the story of him going back home, and we have much to learn there, too, of his ascent from the deep place to a place of welcome. And the third scene is the scene of an angry older brother standing outside, refusing to be part of what's the celebration that's happening inside. So with that in mind, we're not going to read it again, but I am going to try and take up a phrase or some phrases from each of these scenes and try and walk back into it so we can experience it together. So in scene one, we begin with this phrase, "Give me the share of property that is coming to me." The younger son, father had two sons, the younger son out of the blue comes up and says, "Give me the share of the property that is coming to me." Now this, in its time, it is insulting in any time, but it is particularly, staggeringly insulting in the time in which it was spoken, in the culture in which Jesus is telling this story. The younger son is not just asking his father for money, or pressuring his father for money even. "I want money, I want to get on with my life." He wants his inheritance in particular, which is another way of saying, "Old man, why aren't you dead yet? I have no use for you. I have no use for anything about you. I will get maximum income when you're gone. Why haven't you bothered to die yet?" And with that kind of awful dismissal of his father, in public now, the young man sells the property. It becomes obvious what he's done, what he's said, what he believes about his father. And his father is completely humiliated. Others in the village would have seen it. The disrespect with which he's treating his father, the father would have to live with, the humiliation that's attached to it. Secondly, we might notice the importance of the word "me" in this young man's description. "Give me what's coming to me." When his older brother speaks later, it's very similar, by the way. He says, "I have served, I have obeyed, I deserve what I deserve." Each one of them has a powerful sense of their own rights, their own requirements, what's coming to them, and so on. A third thing we might notice in this first scene is the role that money plays. The value that's put on having this world's goods, this world's property, the money that it can extract having been sold, what it does to have money. And if there is any place in the world that needs to come to some grips with and some understanding of the power of money to persuade and command and seduce, it's our place in the world. Paul Taylor has led a group of men in the last few months to meet together and wrestle with what men's ministry might look like at PBC as it goes forward. And one of the things that's come up over and over again is guys saying, the pressure that's on here to succeed financially, it's the possibility of being able to live here successfully, what money says about who you are, having or not having, grasping or not, it's a powerful, powerful temptation and pressure. And I think all that's going on in this story is part of the valley story. People too young, with too much money, too much power, blindsided by what happens, losing their way. So this story may resonate for some of us on that level. And may the Lord give us insight as to how not to end up eating with the pigs. Second phrase we take from the first scene is that he, the younger son, took a journey into a far country. Now, this is a geographical statement. He left. He went somewhere else. But it's much more than that. What he's doing is completely severing his roots. He has sold whatever property had belonged to his family that might have come to him. There is no place for him left. He's never coming back as far as he knows. And what he's leaving behind are all the relationships, all the values, all of the boundaries, all of the people in his life who might have spoken to him and helped him, all of the folks who might have appealed to him for help that he could be a part of. He's leaving his network. He's leaving the moral universe that shaped him. He's cutting himself off from everything that might have sustained him otherwise. He wants nothing to do with the world he'd been in. He left for a far country, and he's leaving for good. The phrase that is ridiculous but commonplace, that what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, is, of course, completely not true. But it doesn't, even that is not helpful in this case, the fact that such a statement is not true. Because the implication of that is stays in Vegas is you're going to go back home. You go to Vegas, you party, you make a fool of yourself, do stuff that is shameful, but you leave it there and come back home. This guy's never going to come back home, as far as he knows. He's going to Vegas to stay. The party is on. He never intends, as far as he knows, to come back. And the things that are taken away in Vegas are never returned. Inhibitions are lost. The moral compass that your home country might have given you has been forfeited by him. Third statement is he squandered his property in reckless living. The easy money leads to out of control behavior, which leads to dissipation. It's a familiar pattern. You don't have to be Christian to have this, for parents to be able to warn children about what's out there and what can happen. It's true in every culture, every time in history, that too much, too soon, without guidance, without boundaries, is dangerous. And it, sure enough, in this case, it leads to reckless living. You can sort of imagine this guy showing up in the far country with lots of dough. And he just finds himself shocked. I just have so many friends. And I used to have a hard time making friends, but gosh, here everybody is my friend. It's amazing. It's wonderful. I'm just much smarter and much more, my ideas are taken more seriously here in the far country. And girls like me, who knew? I'm just shocked at how attractive I've become all of a sudden. And they laugh at my jokes. No one ever laughed at my jokes before. And just sort of this, he's a world built on soap bubbles, facades, false friends, and the reckless living. The party life goes on until it ends. He squandered his property in reckless living. The fourth phrase in scene number one is that a severe famine arose in that country. And the famine will always come. The crisis will show up. It is inevitable. The reckless living, the party world, the imagined experience that everything is always and relentlessly in my favor, it ends. The crisis comes, the famine, and he finds himself in a desperate place. And verse 16 tellingly says, all his former friends, no one would give him anything. He's lost it all. It is the anti-banquet in the field where he's trying to feed pigs what he cannot eat himself, all alone, desperate, starving. It's the lowest possible place. Now the Pharisees, who grumbled about Jesus eating with sinners, they would have liked this story up to this point, I think. If you do foolish and terrible and sinful and immoral things, you ought to pay a price. It ought to lead you into the dark place. It ought to put you in the pit. Sinners ought to be in a pit. That makes sense. That's kind of the way things ought to shake out. He had savaged his father. He'd behaved shamefully. He'd lost everything. And this guy, even compared to some other tales of self-inflicted destruction, this guy can't even say that, he had a tough upbringing. Sometimes the story of a person who ruins his own life is the story of a treated so badly in childhood, so many things gone wrong, so much hardship, so much abuse, so much rejection. You live out the tale of your early life, your tragic early life, and tragedy follows. But this guy didn't have a tragic early life. He was loved by his father. He had a home that was winsome, and he still decided to wreck everything. And sure enough, he ends up in a deep hole, and that's the way it ought to be. Except the story doesn't end there. And this is where it begins to get remarkable, breathtaking, unbelievable. In verse 17, it says, first phrase for the second of these scenes, it says, he came to himself. Now, I'm arbitrarily going to insert a corny joke here because I said I would. I'm trying to revive the corny joke thing at PBC. So here's where it gets arbitrarily inserted in the sermon. So the preacher's telling this story, and he gets to this phrase, and he says, the young man was desperate, he was starving, and he's had to sell his hat for food. Sometime later, he's still starving, he has to sell his shoes. And then he has to sell his jacket for food, he's still starving, and finally he sells his shirt, and he came to himself. Shirt's gone, anyway. So I told you it was a corny joke, and there you are. Yes, hissing is good. That makes sense. However, the question for us is, what does the phrase he came to himself actually mean? And scholars debate here as to whether this young man actually repented in his woeful circumstance. Was his heart broken before God, or is this something more like, I'm in a mess and I need to get out of it? And I think it's ambiguous. I don't think we can say for sure what's going on. I don't think this guy understood himself what's going on. He makes the statement, you know, I've sinned before heaven and before you, before my father. And if he was saying that on his own terms, that I think would be more meaningful. But the problem is, it's a speech he's writing. I'm going to go tell my father these things because I have something I want still from this old man. But does he mean it? Maybe he does. Maybe he doesn't. I think he's in a place where when all is lost, he's combining recollection of the servants in his father's home, desperation in his own circumstance, calculation, remorse, all of these things together and trying to figure out what to do next. There's still no banquet in sight for him. He never hopes ever to be put back in any place of honor. He just wants to go to a place where he might earn enough so he doesn't starve. And then the story the light begins to flood in and the music gets scary and unfamiliar. While he was still, this is the second phrase in scene two, while he was still a long way off, his father saw him. Now the implication of that, while he was still a long way off, means that his father is looking for him. And however many months or years it took for him to make a mess of his life, I think we're supposed to conclude that his father has spent every day looking down the road hoping his son will come back. There's no telegram ahead. There's no sense that today is the day. And the father every day has been hoping for, longing for the return of his lost son. Why? Why didn't he handle it different, we might ask? Why didn't he refuse to give the inheritance to the son? Maybe that's another question. Why did he allow things to go so far? Why didn't he intervene sooner? Why didn't he go to the far country and get his son and drag him back or manipulate him or something? Why does he just wait with his own heart breaking for his son to come back? Well, part of the mystery is the mystery of what love is like. Love only really exists. Love only really thrives. It's only real when it's chosen absent manipulation, absent force, absent a twisted arm, absent the insistence of the beloved. The Father's waiting. And I think what this says about God's vulnerability, as this, the Father is certainly the Lord God in this story, his vulnerability, he has been humiliated by his son, his heart is breaking still. He refuses to ravish the son, manipulate the son. He is waiting for his son to come home. And we're seeing the kind of God the Pharisees know nothing about in this story. And it gets worse. or more remarkable, depending on your perspective. The third phrase, the father ran. He ran and embraced him and kissed him. Now, everything about that short sentence is humiliating to the father. A stately older man in the culture of his time would never run. They wore long robes. They walked slowly. They would never recklessly run. He's doing it in public. He's calling attention to himself. He finds his son at a distance. He embraces him, kisses. He's crying. Everything about this action is further to lower the father's status in the eyes of everyone around him. It's further spending of himself for the sake of his son. It is the exact counterpoint to what the son did to him. The son who said, I want you dead. And here's the father who's crying his eyes out because his son's still alive. The tenderness of it, the unexpectedness of it. Who is this father? Why so much? The ring, the robe, the party tent, the joy, completely unexpected. It shocks us. And yet, if it's true, if God longs for his children to come to him this way, what does it suggest about people like us? People who disrespect our father all of the time, just by our callousness and so on. Final phrase in scene two is, my son was dead, he's alive again. He was lost, and he is found. Now the perspective of Jesus that those who are in a broken relationship with him are not in this language, are not failures, they're not rejects, they're not the broken, the unwanted, the ruined, they are the lost. It's an important perspective. Something valuable is lost as far as God's concerned for those who are apart from relationship in him. They're lost and they're being looked for. They're not rejects. They're something immensely important to him, and he longs to find what is lost. Dead, now alive, lost, and now found. There's a couple of things I want to say before we go on to the third scene, the scene of the older brother. This is a story. It is not a systematic theology. This story doesn't tell us everything about the rescue of sinners. There's no explicit description of a sacrifice offered, for instance. There's no cross. There's no exact representation of the fullness of the cross. Although in the humiliation and personal lowering of himself that the Father does, we see certainly echoes of the cross, the humiliation of Jesus on the cross, the God giving up everything in order to save us. But, you know, there isn't an explicit reference to it. We don't know everything there is to know because of this story about the way God brings home his children. It's a story. It's supposed to connect viscerally with us. It's supposed to seize our imagination and help us believe things that even if we can't understand them. And so we should not ask this to do what it never was intended to do and cannot do, because it's a parable, it's a story. But we can see the son, the deepest point of his life, and think about some of the options he has. One of his options is to pull himself up by his bootstraps, but that'll never work. Another is to give way to self-hatred and despair and stay in the company of the pigs and end his life there, however it ends. We can see him trying to make some deal with somebody for something and exercise all his deal-making skills. We can see him trying to seize advantages from outsiders. We can see sort of the options that are presented to someone who's gone as deeply as he can. But there's no other option like this. What if I'm loved even while I'm here? What if I have a father like this who's going to seek the lost one, who's looking down the road for me? What What if it's true that I don't have to live with either self-effort or despair? Those aren't the only roads anywhere. What if I'm beloved? We're supposed to have a visceral, as I said, a visceral response to this story. It's supposed to capture our guts, if you will. And it turns out the only emotional response that we have in the story itself to the overwhelming love of the father is the anger of the older brother. The only person that does react, in this story at least, to what he's seen, is the older brother who's really ticked off. Instead of being amazed, he's furious. And so we'll go back into that part of the text, starting with this phrase. He was angry, and he refused to go in. There's a party going on, hears that there's a party, comes, finds out what it is. His younger brother is being welcomed home with great joy and celebration. There's no reluctance to this. There's overflow. And he comes and he's ticked. And he refuses to go in. And what that means is that once again, his father is going to humiliate himself. Once again, on behalf of one of his sons, the father is going to do what no father in this culture would ever have done, and that is go out, back again, into public, implore his son to come in. You know, fathers were the rulers of their home. You would command your son to come in if he did anything. You wouldn't act with such kind of egregious humiliation. Please, son, come in. Please understand what's happening. Please welcome your brother. He won't name his brother. It's your son who's gone off to squander his life. It's not my brother. And so this angry son further humiliates his father. And we sense, I think, almost certainly jealousy. He's been off with prostitutes. I've been here with full rectitude doing everything I ought to do for, you know, endlessly without fail. But, you know, you sort of can imagine, well, I wish I'd, you know, been able to sin freely, perhaps, as my brother did. I knew a man once, as many years ago, when divorce in church was more of a kind of a black mark than it is now, a sort of a negative, than it puts you outside the pale, if you will. Anyways, a long time ago, he was on a board of directors for an organization, and there was some thought that somebody should be put into leadership in the organization who many years before had a marriage that failed. He'd remarried and was honoring God in his new family relationship. And this person was going to either vote yes or no as to whether this guy should come on into the organization in leadership. He said, no, never. It's unthinkable. Divorce is it's impossible. You know, anybody who's failed in that way is not fit for Christian leadership. And you know, he was really angry about it and just kind of back up. And I got to know this guy for a while over time, not super well, but well enough to know that he was one of the most unhappily married men I'd ever known. His marriage was painful, it was miserable, it was sort of a daily struggle to stay in, and I began to realize that one of the reasons he would not let this other person involved in the organization is because he wanted to be out of his marriage. And he didn't know how to fix it. He didn't know where to go. He didn't know what to do about it except feel resentment. And there's some of that in the older brother here. It's not just that he's a failure, but his failure is exposing my heart more than I want it to. He's jealous of the brother who got to live out this sort of wild existence. The second phrase in this final scene, these many years I have served you and never disobeyed your command. As an exalted sense of what he's done for someone else. The word serve can mean slave. It's a Greek word that's most often, I've slaved for you, Father. I've never disobeyed you, Father. I am morally pure. I've extended myself to the uttermost. I'm misused and misunderstood and underappreciated. My standing is immense. No one sees it but me. There's a kind of whiny, tiny, emotional tightness around this guy that he doesn't understand. He's lying to himself and he can't see it. The emotional deceit is tremendous. and his anger is all that he has to operate with. And the father's answer is short but powerful. Son, if you wanted anything, you'd have it. Everything I have is yours. You are always with me. What you are trying to earn, you already have. There's nothing that would bring joy or honor or beauty to your life if you wanted it that I would withhold from you. All that I have is yours. All of this angry and self-centered behavior that doesn't accomplish anything because you already have what you're trying to win, what you're trying to earn. And so the story ends there. Did he come in or not? We don't know. We actually don't know for sure if the younger son ever learned a lesson either. Maybe after he's been restored, he'll once again charge off in some selfish behavior. We don't know exactly how these sons turn out. Certainly the second son. We don't know how he turns out at all. The story just ends. But then it therefore asks the question of us, what about us? You know, will we come in? Will we have table fellowship with Jesus? Will we receive what he's offering us? The story of the prodigal son, as we've referenced already, is one of the most famous, best known, most influential document, story, text that's ever been written. If you were a Bible scholar interested in the great themes of the Bible and the structures of the Bible, you might say, well, here's another story of a father that had two sons. It's the Cain and Abel story again. It's the Ishmael and Isaac story again. It's the Jacob and Esau story again. A father, sons, conflict. It's part of a great theme. It's themes of the Bible once again. If you were a literary sort, you might say, this is one of the greatest stories, let alone Bible stories, stories ever written. It takes up all the stuff that makes us human. It's a generational conflict. It's sibling conflict. It's all the stuff that any story has to be about, families and people and difficulty and resolution and so on. If you were a psychologist, you might say, here is a study in attraction disorders. Why do these two guys hate their father so much? He never did anything to them. What in the Sam Hill makes them so furious at him? And so maybe we see, you know, some discovery of, psychological issues. But the people who want to see Jesus, who want our, people like us, I hope, who want our hearts changed by what's here, we will find our gaze steady on the Father. Not the other things that make up this story, but who is the Father? What extraordinary person gives up everything to have back in his embrace those who have mistreated him so? Those who are both unworthy and unloving, and yet he loves them. His suffering and humiliation, his patient waiting, looking down the road for the one who's not returned yet. He overcomes the younger son's degradation, despair, and anger. He insists on celebration. The far country is not too far away. The hard heart and self-brewed bitterness of the older son are not too much for him. Relentlessly, he pursues his sons, whether they are sinner or Pharisee. He will have them at his table. The Pharisees grumbled that Jesus ate with sinners, but he always has. There is no one else to eat with. He names them not sinners, but sons and daughters. Let's hear his voice. Let us eat and celebrate. For this my child was dead and is alive again, was lost and now is found. Pray with me if you would. Lord, let us have fellowship at your table. Let us give up what keeps us away. Let us see you in your love for us. Make us welcome, Lord, and allow us to welcome others, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.